You're listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void.
Smart money's on hollow, and the moon is in the street, and the shadow boys are breaking all the laws. You're east of East St. Louis, and the wind is making speeches, and the rain sounds like a round of applause. And invisible fiancés in the mirror. The band is going home. It's raining hammers,
it's raining nails.
It's true, there's nothing left for him down here. And it's
song, one of my favorites. We travel slowly with ice cream cones over the bumpy, disused highway. It's Highway 1. It's highway time on Sunday afternoon. My father in the front seat, my mother in the back with me. I never questioned this. The ice cream is cold and running down my hand, a little too quickly for me to keep up. Take small, neat, librarian nips. I'm waiting for what I always wait for. Eventually, my father pulls the DeSoto down the strange strip of dirt that exceeds into the distance toward the faraway farm, the rumble of the dirt beneath the soft tires. My father was always taking air out of those tires. I wish I could ask him about this now, but it's too late. And the sun was setting over the cornfields, a cherry fire, an orange blaze of furnace smoke. the sound of our car door slamming as we stood and looked over the rotting corpse of the home my father grew up in. And there's the silo where Jed and me used to hide, and we had two cows out there on the pasture. It always smelled like fresh-cut grass and spoiled milk and manure in the barns. It was the barns that I loved so much back then. These barns, which were tipping to one side with warped boards cleaned free of paint. These barns had been abandoned, but they had been abandoned to beauty. They were no longer barns. They were themselves. Listening to atoms, motion, and the void. I was a prolific joke writer as a child. I remember only one. Once upon a time, in a beautiful fairyland, there was a princess who, after a long search, found her prince charming in the form of a farm boy named Manuel, who preferred the company of horses to that of his fellow man. Regardless, they lived happily ever after until they died. I never got one laugh out of it. I also did a card trick that I called One Card Montague. So amazing was this magic that no one even understood what I was doing. I would simply approach a fellow third grader like meek David Hanf, cut open the deck and present the card to him like an FBI badge. "Is this your card?" I would ask in the magician's tone of absolute knowing. David Hanf did not get it. He did not understand the deep magic at work. "Don't you get it? Don't you see the magic? Why don't any of you get my joke?" But these small children in their colorful jackets did not. I returned to eating pencils and bouncing BBs around the surface of my desk like a useless turd toy of a mountaintop madman. Let me tell you a story of my day shopping. I went to the supermarket. As I approached, I saw the three balusters of shopping carts, all pressed together like cows inserting into one another. I went over and grabbed my cart, rotated it, and then made the brief commute across the esplanade and entered the automatic doors. I did my shopping. I did so from a list. I did not shop hard or heavy, and when I was done, I had only 2 bags in my cart, which I could easily carry. I am quite diligent about my cart. When I have used it, I will place it either in the carrel out in the lot, or I will return its bojangling shriekingness all the way back to the more official location, the place where the shopping cart collector person will bring them. I do this because there is a social pressure that arises, a conflict that I wish to avoid. By leaving the cart pell-mell and willy-nilly in the parking lot, not politely shifted into the carrel, or even more considerately returned to central casting, one is announcing in a whisper that one is quite an important person, a first-classer, someone a little too busy and special to bother with candy wrappers. Now, this is not exactly true, but it is my reality, my perception, my illusion. I grow nervous and wiggly around those who might find my actions communicating a kind of arrogance. So, in order to avoid accusations of superior self-belief, I am very nearly pernicious in my special forces style, taking care of ness around those who, let's face it, are my subordinates. My good friend V.S. Naipaul calls them infies, for inferiors. I just call them possibly violent and let go at that. I do my best to keep the order. Which brings me to my point. There were shoppers entering the store who were unaware that the rolly carts were kept outside for the sake of neatness. I watched a few of these deeply self-absorbed citizens sharpen to their halts, look up in a daze of world discovery, ripping themselves from the internal registers, and noting that there were no carts ahead or inside the entryway. They turned around, went back out. So, to assist one of these dreamers, because I did not need to wheel my cart to my vehicle, I exited, swiveled around, lifted my bags, and drew my rolly cart to the side so that an entering dreamer could just pick it up and save themselves a few feet of walking. Now, this was perhaps a too complex action on my part. I should not be so arranging the world, putting banana peels near the cruel feet of possible bad guys. But I could not help but follow the urge of efficiency, for to return my cart would be less efficient than simply handing it off to a needful stranger, like a baton in a relay race. Here, I might say, it's a good cart with 4 smoothly going wheels and no rust. I highly recommend it. But such exchanges are not what we're about. We figure a silent space instead of a possible mix-up between aliens. But in a lost and found type of fashion, I placed my cart where it was most needed. But wouldn't you know it? An elderly cart keeper in an orange vest, large silver glasses, and a scrubbed pink face saw me and came over and drew the cart away. He watched me properly, and I watched him, and he slammed it into the huge line of waiting rollies. A little proud, a little angry, a little job well done. He'd put me in my place. Well, no. I was bearing this because, as he turned, he saw what I had seen. A woman staring at him from just nearby the place of pickup. "I would have taken that," she said as she passed him. His urge for order, our urge for order, for re-establishing the show of convenience, was an inconvenience to this woman. And thus I may say that it is quite possible that if carts were left to their own devices, perhaps in a litter around the parking lot, left where they were last emptied, we might find in that chaos a new kind of order. My suggestion is that such disordered order exists all around us, from the messy desk of the eccentric who can locate his mysterious papers far quicker than neat Professor Glossy Eyes down the hall. So, let us remove the lines from the parking lot, unpaint the highways, take down the signs that say, "Stop and go." There's no need for the man to direct me hither and you yon, Let's get out of the angle enclosure and shoot nicely out in big wide waves, like stones splashing into a pond. Outward, outward, down and up. As Leonard Cohen says, you go your way, I'll go your way too.
Like a bird on the wire, like a drunk in a midnight choir, I have tried in my way to be free. Night from some old-fashioned book, I have saved all my ribbons for thee. If I have been that you can just let it go by. If I have been untrue, I hope you know it was never to you. With his horn, I have torn everyone who reached out for me. But I swear by this song and by all that I have done wrong, I will make it all.
I recently had the opportunity to see a film. The film was called Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants. It's about four best friend girls, two chubby, two not, who are scattered to the winds one summer in their 17th year. To stay in touch, they become a sisterhood of the traveling pants. Pants that magically fit each one of them, despite their different shapes. Lena goes to Greece and overcomes the obstacle of her stubborn shyness. The blonde girl goes to soccer camp in Mexico and confronts the suicide of her mother and the lack of love from her father by sleeping with a soccer counselor on the beach of her grieving despair. The chubbiest of the girls goes to spend the summer with her father, who surprises her with the fact of his new family. Amber Tamblyn is the girl who doesn't go anywhere. She instead works at the local Warman's and makes a documentary about losers. Each of the girls apparently has a special episode in the pants, but I was not keen enough to detect the circumstance in which the event occurred while the pants were being worn. I have nothing to say about this film, except at the end I announced, "Well, There ends another episode of Desperate House Pants, as it felt just like an adolescent version of that television program, with all the different hair colors and feminine attitudes represented, and the gossipy, over-talking style of purest codependence, and the sudden flare-ups of sex mixed in with real concerns and worldly ambitions and flecked with suicide and imminent child death. It's not true the show has started. Now the show has started. Don't believe me when I say that my first word was facetious.
Sheafus.
I said Sheafus, and I said it a lot, and appropriately, apparently. And I believe it.
Sheafus, 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 Sheafus.
Facetiousness was a dominant emotional awareness of my young life, in that I considered that no one around me was actually being serious or literal with me about anything. This must be a joke. This junky, silly planet. These ridiculous tasks, one odder than the next, all governed by a system of conflicting rules that were like child's warning labels. Don't eat this or you'll get fat. And really, one had nothing to do with the other. Some children ate them and didn't get fat, and some did. Fatness has nothing to do with eating this or that. Even the goofus bowler hat shape of the family De Soto, the fact that my mother would never just wear a pair of my father's trousers, even if in doing so she would save a life. The lemonade, we had to be excited about at the first signs of summer. I must be an alien, I thought. There must be some very profound and unusual experiments to test my reactions to see how well I grapple with the nature of what should be.
Chiefus.
Would I see the subtle fallacies, the gross injustices? Or would I blend into the blur of glossy-eyed dreamongers? I know I'm an alien, I regularly said to my parents. Just tell me which planet, so I may look homeward with a properly directed nighttime gaze.
Chiefus.
I always thought that people were funning with me. I still do, and I still say, Chiefus.
Chiefus, Chiefus, Chiefus.
Listening to Adam's Motion and the Void.
Now I'm waking at the crack of dawn. And now my bags are down and packed for traveling. Looking at happiness, keeping my flavor fresh. Nobody knows, I guess, how far I'll go. I know, so I'm leaving at 6 o'clock. Meeting a parking lot, Harry and Hendershot. Sunglasses on, she waits. Except a couple tiny holes and openings where the city's blowing in and out. And this is what it's all about. Delightfully, everything's possible when you're an animal. Not inconceivable how things can change. I know, so I'm putting on aftershave. Nothing is out of place, gonna be on my way. Try to pretend it's not.
Thank you.